All right. So for those of you keeping score at home, you may know that I have 8 Wednesdays left to get through the end of Revelation. And if you're good at math, you'll know we're on chapter 12, right? So we have 11 chapters to do in 8 weeks. That's a lot of work. So we're going to be taking some pretty big chunks. The pace is picking up. You guys have figured out, Lord willing, some skills in reading apocalyptic literature. So we're going to move through. So tonight we're going to take a look at chapters 12 and 13. Chapters 12 and 13, right? Because chapter 12 all by itself, not challenging, right? Might as well do it left-handed. No, just kidding. But all right, so let's just quickly review the ground we've covered, right? So we started off with the Lord Jesus Christ in his glory, in his exaltation, in the midst of and speaking to his to the 7 churches, right? And this begins to illuminate us to the fact that 7 is an important number in this book, right? So that 7 represents fullness, completion, perfection, right? So this is a letter to 7 particular churches, but it's also a letter to the universal church, the 7 representing kind of the complete witness of the church. So we see the full range of positive letters, negative letters, and churches that are kind of in between, both with positive and negative traits, just like we would expect to find in a comprehensive letter to all the churches. Okay, then we see we had a great vision of the throne room of God, right, in which the 7 churches are kind of a mess, right, and they're in a context of persecution and trial and unfaithfulness. So there's lots going on here. But then this is contrasted with the fact that the throne room of God is a place of perfect peace and calm, where God rules and reigns in total sovereignty. There's no chaos. There's glory. So there's a little bit of kind of dissonance between Jesus reigning in the midst of his churches, which are kind of a mess in persecution, but this heavenly scene of glory and rule and reign and peace and victory. So the question is, how are we going to see these reconciled, right? And the question is, the way it's phrased in Revelation, who can open the seals of the scroll of God and unveil and execute and see through to completion God's purposes for judgment and salvation to bring about the rule and reign of God over everything? So that there's not this dissonance of God's rule and reign in heaven with a chaotic situation on earth, but who can execute all of God's purposes in judgment and salvation? And what we find out is, it's the very same Jesus that we encountered at the beginning. He's the one who has died, who has been raised, who is in glory, and who is able to take the scroll from the Father and execute God's purposes of judgment and salvation. And so this begins the process where we have a cycle, we have these cycles of judgment and or salvation, right? And the first cycle is executed in the 7 seals as the scroll is open. If you had to summarize the content of the 7 seals, what would be kind of the major points in summarizing? What happens when all the 7 seals are open? Okay? When does, like, death and destruction, immediate, total, complete? How does it work? Partial judgment and limited judgment that moves towards what? Total, complete, comprehensive judgment within the day of the Lord and the ultimate victory of God on the great day of the Lord, right? So there's a cycle in which we move from partial, limited judgment unto total, comprehensive judgment and victory for the people of God. Who can stand in the great day? All the people of God can stand, right? So there's total and complete judgment and total and complete salvation, right? Then we come to what comes next. Anyone? Addie, you can help them out because you get the secret angle here, right? So we have the seven seals, which are then followed up by the seven trumpets, right? And why seven? Why seven seals? Why seven trumpets? Because seven represents completion, perfection. So it's the complete, perfect rolling out and execution of God's judgment and the complete, comprehensive salvation of all of God's people. That's what we see in the seal cycles. What do we see in the trumpet cycles? We do have some trumpets. Very good. Very good. Craig, maybe you could give us a similar answer to what we had last time. Well, there's a recapitulation, right? So this is not seven things happening after this, but kind of the story being retold, recapitulated. And as it's recapitulated, what do we encounter in the trumpet cycle? Judgment. What kind of judgment at first? Partial, limited, controlled, measured judgment. Judgments in this little different perspective. Judgments that are poured out on the earth. Then judgments that are poured out on the people, right? Then we have this interlude of the word of God going and having its full effect. It can't ultimately be stopped even by death, right? And then the complete victory of God. So we have, again, comprehensive judgment going forth, definitive judgment to the very end of the of all things. And then we have the comprehensive triumph of the gospel and the salvation of God's people. Are you starting to pick up a theme? How about you, Eddie? Yep, Eddie's picking up a theme. Right. So now what we're going to do is we're going to come to a new cycle, right? In chapter 12, we begin a new cycle. And one of the definitive markers of this is a totally new short film, right? It's almost like there's opening credits to mark this is, you know, we've got closing credits, right? Which we've seen at the end of both of the seal cycle and the trumpet cycle. The closing credits of the movie is there were flashes of lightning, rumblings, peals of thunder, earthquake, right? And then there's the opening credits to kind of mark a new film is a sign appearing in heaven or something coming down out of heaven, right? So that's what we have in 12:1. A great sign appeared in heaven. So now we know we're on to a new cycle. This is a new film that you don't have to try to figure out how this woman comes after the trumpet. No, it's like you watched this short film at the Revelation Sun Film Festival, right? And then you said, oh, I like that one. And then you said, oh, the trumpet one, that one was also very good, reinforced a lot of these themes, but in a kind of nuanced and distinct way. Now we're into another one, which a lot of people will call the seven sacred histories, right? What we're going to have here is we're going to have a film that's really going to focus in on distinct characters and their activity, right? Let's see. The symbolic histories. That's what sacred histories, symbolic histories. And what we're going to do tonight is we're going to try to get through all of 12 and 13 by identifying four of these symbolic histories. Okay. So what we have here is we have the history or the connection, the life of the woman, right? So we see that in 12:1. And a great sign appeared in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun, and there's some descriptions about her, right? So we're going to talk about the woman. Then we're going to talk about the dragon, right? This is picking up in 3. Another sign appeared in heaven, behold, a great red dragon. And then we have 2 kind of accounts of conflict between the woman and the dragon, and offspring of the woman and the dragon. Then when we get into 13, we have the beast, and this is the beast that emerges out of the sea. And then over here, we have a second beast that emerges from the land, right? So this, so that's what we're going to try to cover tonight. Who are these, and how? What is the significance for us? Okay, so let's read first about this woman. A great sign appeared in heaven. A woman clothed with the sun and with the moon under her feet, and on her head a crown of 12 stars, right? She was pregnant, crying out in birth pains and the agony of giving birth, right? So let's try to figure out who is this woman, right? As you're reading about this woman, like, and you read it here, what are some of the first thoughts that pop into your mind? Who might this woman be? Okay. So we've got this woman could be Israel, right? What's that? Okay, there's a guess. Could be Babylon. There's a, you know. Anyone else? If you're a Roman Catholic, what's the classic interpretation? This is Mary, right? Because she ends up giving birth to a male child, right? So again, when we see images in the book of Revelation, what's the first place that we look to try to understand and interpret and decode those images, if you will? We look to the Old Testament. So if you look at this language, a woman clothed with the sun, the moon under her feet, on her head a crown of 12 stars. Any, you know, if you have a book with cross references, or maybe you're like, wait, I know something in the Old Testament that kind of sounds like that. Anyone want to take a stab? Sarah Hilscher lit up like for a second. Okay, so here we go. So we've got 12 stars, right? So that would probably, and 12, as we've seen throughout the book, tends to symbolically represent what? Well, just 12 tends to represent 12 tribes, 12 apostles. It's the number of the people of God, the fullness of the people of God, right? So we've got 12. That would kind of lend ourselves up here, right? The description seems to be to defy perhaps a personal description. But so anybody have, if you have your Bible with you, flip over to Genesis chapter 37. Okay. And in Genesis chapter 37, what do we find? You might recall this is the start of the Joseph narrative. And Joseph has a dream. Someone read about the dream that he dreamed beginning in verse 9. Someone want to try to read that out loud? Nice and loud for us. Brilliant. That's good, right? But what do we have there, right? We have the sons of Jacob, right, who would become the 12 tribes. And from this dream, they are bowing down, but they are represented in the dream how? Sun, moon, 12 stars, right? So there's language there. There's a woman, right, with the sun and the moon, and on her head a crown of 12 stars. So that would seem to make, you know, I think we can start to lean towards, I don't think we're talking about Babylon. There are going to be other women that we're going to encounter here, right, in Revelation, in which I'm going to say, who do you think this is? And James, I'll kind of look at you like this. And you can say, Babylon? Yes. Now it doesn't seem to, we don't seem to be talking Babylon here, right? There seems to be, this would seem to be the language of Israel, the people of God. Also, we have this language of Israel being potentially represented as a woman who is in labor pains, right? Is that present in the Old Testament at all? It's a loaded question. The answer was no, I probably wouldn't be asking it, right? Just a couple places to consider. In Isaiah, let's see here, can't even read my own notes. Isaiah 54, Israel, especially verse 3, Israel is presented as a woman in labor, longing to give birth. Similar in Isaiah 66. Israel is represented, the people of God represented as a woman in labor, right? So that would seem to be the connection here, that this would seem to be speaking of kind of Israel, and kind of this would be the language of this would be the people of God, right? The people of God, right? I think that's the right reading here, that this woman represents not a single woman, but this woman represents Israel as the people of God. And then we're going to see later, this woman is going to give birth to a male child, right? So let's just hold that thought for a second until we turn and we say, so we see this, behold, there's another sign, a red dragon with 7 heads and 10 horns and on his head, 7 diadems. Whew. Right? 7, 10, 7. Right? Any thoughts on who this dragon might be? Yeah. If you're really kind of, I don't know. Later in the chapter, it's going to talk about the great dragon. I think it's the same dragon, right? This is in verse 7. The dragon, the great dragon, that ancient serpent who is called the devil and Satan, right? So I think we are on very solid footing. When the Bible says the dragon is Satan, we're on solid footing to say, I think the dragon is Satan, right? So what do we make of this? This kind of 7 and 10 and 7. What do 7 heads, 10 horns, 7 diadems? What would we say here? How has the number 7 functioned throughout the book? Kind of completion, right? How does the number 10 tend to function throughout the book of Revelation? Well, I think there's another number that's going to come into play here that's going to be short of completion. 10 tends to represent great multiples of 10. There's kind of a robust kind of number. So this would seem to be saying, here is Satan who seems to have kind of full, complete power, right? It's almost like the appearance of omniscience, right? That's pretty scary. The thought that here's that Satan might be have 7, you know, full, complete, right? It's kind of scary, but that seems to be what's being said here. There's a fullness. There's a seeming completeness to this dragon. There's a magnitude of his power and might. And yet, what's interesting here is he 7 heads, 10 horns. He sweeps down 1/3 of the stars of heaven and casts them to the earth. Right. So 2 different ways that scholars have looked at this. Some have seen this kind of in more literal, kind of just showing kind of cosmic power, throwing stars down. Some ancient interpreters talked about the stars of heaven being the people of God, and so he afflicts by a great battle against them. Others have said the stars here represent angels, and this is kind of the primordial battle where Satan kind of takes 1/3 of the angelic host with him in a great rebellion. I don't know if it's super clear, right? But I think here's what we can say is what's interesting is that he seems to have this kind of omniscient power, but when his victory, his conquest is partial, right? So it kind of raises, like, does he have omniscient power? God also at times judged with 1/3 and 1/3. Is it because he's controlled and he always gets what he wants and he's just now measuring his victories? Or is it a seeming omnipotence, which he actually can't take all that he wants? There's kind of a little bit of mystery here, I think, right? It's kind of a compelling story. The dragon stood before the woman who was about to give birth so that when she bore her child, he might devour it. She gave birth to a male child, one who is to rule all the nations with a rod of iron. So the woman gives birth to a child. Who is this child? Okay, how do you know? Okay, he will rule the nations with a rod of iron. Where does that come from? Anybody? Psalm 2, right. So Psalm 2, the language here is God the Father is speaking to his anointed one. He gives him the nations as his heritage, and he will rule them in a rod of iron. So this was a clear messianic prophecy that was then fulfilled. Psalm 2 was quoted multiple times by the New Testament authors and applied specifically to Jesus Christ. So here we have the woman, that is the people of God, and the seed of the woman who is this promised child who is none other than the Lord Jesus Christ. And Satan here wants to kill the child. He wants to devour the child. But it says, her child was caught up to God and to his throne, right? So I think what we've got there, anybody, what do you think? What do you think is the significance of that? Satan's here, he's looming, he's waiting for the birth of the child, but the child then is caught up to God, so he doesn't get him. What do we think's going on there? Any thoughts? Yeah, I think so. I think this is like the whole of the gospel story kind of compressed into one little phrase, right? This is death, resurrection, and ascension into glory, right? So he wants the child, but he doesn't get the child. And then the child is caught up to God and to his throne, and the woman fled into the wilderness. So the woman flees into the wilderness, right? For how long? Where a place is prepared by God for her, where she is to be nourished for 1,260 days. This is not the first time we've seen a number like this. So first of all, what is the biblical significance of the wilderness? Old Testament, what is the meaning of the wilderness? So the wilderness is that place of wandering and pilgrimage unto what? Unto the promised land, right? So Israel has to wander in the wilderness for 40 years before they enter into the promised land, right? And then what we see is that biblically the wilderness kind of represents this life, right? And all of the trials and temptations of this life unto glory, right? So that we are here in this age, a wilderness people, a pilgrim people, longing for our ultimate home. And here he says that she's actually goes to the wilderness to a place that is prepared for her. Now that's interesting. God has actually prepared a place for the woman to dwell in the wilderness for 1260 days, right? Which is also, what's another time measurement that's equal to 1260 days? 42 months. We've seen that. Which is how long? 3.5 years, right? So we've seen this number show up before. And how have we seen this number represented verbally? Times, time, and half a time, right? So all of these numbers, 3.5, times time, and half a time, 42 months, 1260, it's all the same period of time, right? So the question is, what does this number, you know, is it literal? Are we trying to say there's going to be an actual woman in the wilderness for 3.5 years, right? It seems problematic. But what would this number represent symbolically? All the numbers of Revelation have ultimately had symbolic import. And what have we said about 3.5? Not completion, right? So it's a time that's definite, it's measured, but it's limited, and it has a definite end, right? That's so helpful. If instead of trying to build a chart and a graph and charting things out, if you can just hear, when you hear 3.5, 42 months, 1260 days, time, and half a time, to be able to think it's a definite period, but it's a finite period. Whew. That's all right, man. You know, it keeps me awake because Hannah was worried I was about to fall asleep, right? Right? So to think of a period of definite time, but it's not full, complete. It's measured and it has a definite end. So how can we summarize this first encounter between the woman and the dragon and her child. Anyone want to try to do that? What is this story saying? Anyone want to try to put this story, these seven, in their own words? Okay, good, right? So how did he save the child? Yeah, well, I think we can say in context, through the life, death, and resurrection and ascension of Jesus. How does he save the woman in this story? Preparing a place in the wilderness, right? Which may not sound like, that doesn't sound so great. But preparing a place in the wilderness where she will be nourished. He will take care of his church, even in trials, even in persecution. She will be there for a definite period of time that will have a definite end. So I think that's the end of story one. Any comments or questions on that? Now we have like a new film within the film, right? So we're going to tell, in one sense, I'm going to argue, here's a little recapitulation within this cycle. Because now we're going to tell the story of the woman and the child and the dragon again, but from a different perspective. If you had to look, say, what kind of perspective is this? Where is this being viewed from? You're seeing the people of God attacked by Satan. He's rescued up to heaven. The woman remains on earth, and she remains, and she's nourished and protected in the wilderness for a definite period of time. What kind of where's the perspective coming from? You're viewing this story from where? Well, from outside of it, but essentially, I would argue, this is kind of, you're seeing what's going on earth, right? This is the earthly perspective. And I don't mean earthly in a sinful way. I just mean like you're on the ground. You're seeing the woman. He's taken up to heaven, but you're continue to see what's going on here on earth. Okay. Now what I want to argue in the next section is we're going to actually see the same story, but we're going to see it from a heavenly perspective. Right now you're in heaven seeing the same story play out. So now, war arose in heaven, right? We want to ask now, is this, we can see, does it seem like this is events that are taking place after chronologically, or does this seem like this is a recapitulation of the same story, but from a different perspective? Let's explore that. War arose in heaven. Michael and his angels fighting against the dragon. The dragon and his angels fought back, but he was defeated. And there was no longer any place for them in heaven. And the great dragon was thrown down. That ancient serpent who is called the devil and Satan, the deceiver of the whole world. He was thrown down to the earth and his angels were thrown down with him. Right? So what do you think's going on here? And when do you think this took place? Long time ago. Okay, there's one vote. I mean, the book was written 2,000 years ago, so you're kind of pretty safe with that, right? What do you think? Long time? When long time? Primordial. Did someone just say that? That's a nice big word, right? What does it mean? Before the creation of the world. There's a guess, right? This is the great Satan gets thrown down. Okay. How's everybody feel good about that one? Wish you hadn't nodded your head, but that's okay. That's okay. Let's put it to the test, right? And I heard a loud voice in heaven saying, now the salvation and the power and the kingdom of our God and the authority of his Christ have come. For the accuser of our brothers has been thrown down, who accuses them day and night before our God. And they have conquered him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony, for they loved not their lives even unto death. Anybody want to come up with maybe an alternative to suggestion to primordial? This would seem to be a defeat that happens because of Christ, because of the death and resurrection of Christ, right? So here we have the death, resurrection, and ascension packed into one little phrase, he was taken up into heaven, right? Here we have this victory where we see the consequence of the victory, even though it's not, the death, resurrection is not really emphasized, but it seems like this happens. Satan is thrown down because of Jesus' ministry. This is the result of Jesus' ministry. Can anyone rack their brains and say, you only have to go back to the New Testament now, to say, does Jesus ever talk this way? Does Jesus ever see his ministry having the effect of casting Satan down? Yeah. Where, does anyone know where that happens? It's good. My notes are pretty poor here. So we see this in Luke 10. That's the story you're saying. They come back. They have testimony of victory in gospel ministry. And Jesus says, I saw Satan cast down like lightning, right? As a result of Jesus' own ministry, he is now being defeated. He is being, Satan is being bound. We'll come back to that one in Revelation 20. He is being cast down. He's being defeated, right? Similar language in John 12:31. So this would see, this is not just a big stretch. This is biblical language. Jesus sees his ministry as, and the New Testament sees his ministry as a definitive defeat and casting out of Satan. So that he was the great accuser of the brethren and he is able to accuse no more. Right? Now this is interesting because do we ever see scenes in the Old Testament of Satan in heaven accusing the brothers? Job, right? In the book of Zechariah, we see a similar scene where Satan seems to be in a position of like, hey, God, here we are. What about this guy? He's not so great, is he? Right? And so there's some sense in which, I don't pretend to fully understand this, right? In which Satan seems to have had an ability permitted by God to even bring accusations to God about the people of God, and as a result of the ministry of Jesus, that is definitively defeated, right? He's still the accuser of the brethren, but he has been definitively cast out and thrown down. That's pretty good news, isn't it? Right? Now, as a result of the salvation and the power and the kingdom of our God and the authority of his Christ have come, for the accuser of our brothers has been thrown down, who accuses them day and night before our God. And they have conquered him, how? By the blood of the Lamb. That's right. So this is a definitive victory for the people of God as they persevere even unto death. Therefore, so now he's been, so here we have a situation where the perspective is that the child has been rescued up into heaven. So now Satan is on earth seeking to persecute the people of God, but the people of God are preserved in the wilderness. Now we have a situation where Satan is actually cast down, right? As because of the cross and the resurrection and the victory of Jesus. And now we have this twofold kind of challenge and dilemma, which is that the heavens rejoice. Why do the heavens rejoice? Because of the fact that Satan's been cast down, right? Satan's not in heaven accusing the brothers and sisters in Christ, but woe to you, earth and sea, for the devil has come down to you in great wrath because he knows that his time is short. So now as a result, he's now on earth and we have a situation that's similar here, right? Heaven is rejoicing because Satan has been cast down because of the person and work of Jesus. But earth and sea are lamenting and woe is upon them because his wrath is now great on the earth. Right? Does that make sense? And what does he do with that wrath? When the dragon saw that he had been thrown down to the earth, he pursued the woman who had given birth to the male child, right? So the ministry of Jesus, the earthly ministry of Jesus has already taken place. So now we're back, kind of, you can see the overlap of these stories, right? He's been thrown down. He's been defeated by the ministry. Jesus has ascended into heavenly glory and Satan has been thrown down. So now he's on earth with wrath to persecute the woman, the people of God, right? The continued people of God. And the woman was given two wings of the great eagle so that she might fly from the serpent where? Into the wilderness, right? So again, we're seeing the overlap. We're seeing the recapitulation here to the place where she is to be nourished for how long? Time, times, and half a time, right? So again, what we've got is the recapitulation. Here the woman is in the wilderness in order to be cared for 1260 days. Here the woman is in the wilderness to be cared for time, times, and half a time, right? So we have overlapping recapitulation of theme, but with different emphasis, because here it's the ascension of Christ, which is the emphasis, and here it's the casting down of Satan, which is the emphasis. But these two stories go together, right? They overlap on one another. Because of Christ's ascension into glory, Satan is cast down, and now we have the same situation in both stories. The church is in the wilderness where they will be nourished for a definite, limited, finite period of time. Until it's over. Okay? Does that make sense? I think that's what's going on here. So that what we have at the end of both of these stories is Satan scheming to persecute the church while the church is nourished in the wilderness. Which then leads us into the next chapter and these next two, because this is really a story. These beasts highlight how Satan is going to do this work. How is Satan seeking to afflict, devour, persecute the church while she is in her wilderness pilgrimage? And what we learn is Satan is using two beasts to help execute his persecuting agenda, right? So let's learn about these two beasts. So I saw a beast rising out of the sea. Woohoo! Any biblical reference for a beast rising out of the sea. Okay, Leviathan, that's cool, but it's not quite what I had in mind, right? A beast in the sea. Like more specifically, I saw a beast rising out of the sea. When in doubt in the book of Revelation, Daniel's your best guess. Okay, your second best guess is probably Ezekiel. Your second best guess is probably Isaiah. And then you're branching out from there, right? But in doubt, you go, Daniel, yes. Let's look at Daniel, right? Daniel 7. What do we have? Beginning with the first verse. Anyone want to read Daniel 7, 1? Woohoo! There you go, right? Beast coming up out of the sea, right? So I think John, as he writes this, is like, you know, beast coming out of the sea. You see what I'm talking about here, right? Now, if you know anything about Daniel 7, what do the beasts that come out of the sea represent and symbolize? Good. It's nations and kingdoms, right? So the beast represents nations, kingdoms, empires, right? This is human power par excellence, right? The ultimate manifestation of human power in nations, kingdoms, and empires, which we look at and go, wow, those are so awesome. But Daniel sees what? Beasts. He sees beasts, right? Now, as we continue then, 10 horns. Ooh. What else? 7. What else? How many numbers? 10, 7, and 10, right? Right, so here we should not, oh man, the dragon, who's a 7, 10, 7 kind of guy, is working now in and through this beast, right, who's a 10. So it's just, again, I think it's a symbol thing. This, they seem to have omnipotent power, right? They seem to be full and complete and awesome and mighty, right? It's dreadful, right? And then the beast I saw was like a leopard. Its feet were like a bear. Its mouth was like a lion, right? Anywhere you see that kind of language? Daniel, very good, very good. That the very beasts that are described here in Daniel 7 are represented by these same animals, right? So a lot of people spend a lot of time trying to say, oh, this, again, it's if they're thinking entirely future, right? They'll say, oh, this is going to be a beast that's a combination of these things. Could be. But I think what we're seeing here is the beast is kind of represents, it embodies the full expression of nations, kingdoms, empires in the world. And what I would argue is, in the immediate context, what would we probably be talking about? Kind of a beast that embodies all the beasts. Yeah, I think so, right? I think everyone reading this in the first century would say, yep, that's it, right? But then, but here's the thing I would argue, that the nation, that the whole history of history is the story of successive beastly powers, right? And I think when we say it here at the end, we can expect that the beast will rule and reign in some form or, you know, but human power is always at work, building itself up, glorifying itself, and using its power for its own self-interest, which rarely serves the people of God. Okay, so, and this is interesting. To it, the dragon gave his power and his throne and his great authority. So we see this relationship that the dragon is now working through the beast, investing the beast with his power, right? One of its heads seemed to have a mortal wound, but its mortal wound was healed, and the whole earth marveled as they followed the beast, right? If you know the, if you read any of the Left Behind books, then you know that the figure of the beast has like a scar, right? And you're like, ah, that's how you'll know him, right? If at the end of all history, we're standing in glory and we're like, the dude did have a big scar. And I'll be like, my bad, right? But what I think this is probably saying is part of the way kingdoms and nations and empires work is one goes down, and you think, that was the end. And then what always happens? Another one rises up out of the ashes, right? There is a kind of what in empires? Death and resurrection, right? So this is the first indication that this beast who is gets his power from the dragon seems to be like what? He has a mortal wound that seems to have healed. He seems to be one who has experienced death and resurrection. Who does that sound like? Yeah, right? So this, yeah. So here it seems like Antichrist, false, a false Christ, a pseudo Christ, right? And the whole earth marveled as they followed the beast. They worshiped the dragon, for he had given his authority to the beast. And they worship the beast, saying, who is like the beast and who can fight against it? Let me just say this. This is human temptation in every era, because the beast, nations, kingdoms, empires, it's human visible power collated in its greatest form. And people tend to be really impressed with that, right? So there's always a kind of deification of the state, the deification of the nation, of the empire. It's the greatest expression of human power that we can imagine, and people worship it. Not just in ancient Rome, where you actually said, Caesar is Lord, but there's a sense in which that worship takes place all the time. Let me just offer a word of caution, right? If politics is the thing that gets you most energized and most excited, right? It's not that politics are bad, right? But if recognize the temptation to elevate the beast among over everything, this is the ultimate expression of human power. This is worthy of our worship and devotion, right? That's a temptation, not just in a particularly wicked lands, but it's a human temptation in every society. So consider that, okay? The beast was given a mouth uttering haughty and blasphemous words, and it was allowed to exercise authority for how long? 42 months. So the very time that the people are in the wilderness corresponds to the time that the beast has power. So Satan is trying to afflict the people of God for a finite, definite period of time in the wilderness. And during that same period of time, lo and behold, he's given his power to the beast. Right? So the whole time that we live in our pilgrim journey in the wilderness, there are nations and kings and empires who are exalting themselves even over God and calling for human worship and ultimate human allegiance. Authority was given to it over every tribe and people and language and nation. This could mean that at the end of all things, there will be one great government, one beast. But I think it's also saying all people in all time and history have lived under the power of human nations, kings, and authorities, right? So I don't think this is just one beast. I think this is the reality of the beast ruling and reigning throughout all of history, right? It could be at the end of history, there's one particular beast, one beast to rule them all, right? Who ends up, as we'll find out, his end doesn't turn out so well, right? All authority was given it over every tribe, people, language, and nation, all who dwell on earth will worship it. Everyone whose name has not been written before the foundation of the world in the book of life of the Lamb that was slain, right? So this is kind of a negative, right? But this is what we've seen in every single story. As God's judgment is going forth, right? Comprehensive judgment, but comprehensive salvation, right? Everyone will be aligned with the beast except all the people whose names are written in the Lamb's Book of Life, right? So this is great news, even as it's somber news, right? If anyone has an ear, let him hear. If anyone is taken captive, to captivity he goes. If anyone is to be slain with the sword, hear the sword, he must be slain. Here's a call for the endurance and faith of the saints, because we're going to live in our pilgrim wilderness in the midst of the beast for the whole time of our pilgrim journey. So it's a call for perseverance. I know we're running short on time. Let me just say a word then about the second beast. Another beast rising out of the earth. Not really a strong Old Testament correlation there. So you're kind of like, who is this, right? Two horns like a lamb, spoke like a dragon, exercises all the authority of the first beast in its presence, right? So it has the same power and authority as the first beast, who gets all of his power from the dragon, right? And the first beast who's mortal, it performs great signs, even making fire come down from heaven on earth in front of people. And by the signs it is allowed to work in the presence of the beast, it deceives those who dwell on earth, telling them to make an image for the beast that was wounded by the sword and yet lived. All right. Any Old Testament stories that this sounds like? People who work for nation, kingdom, empire, do signs and wonders. Egypt, right? This is like Pharaoh's magicians, right? Representing him, serving him, doing miracles in his name, and drawing people's worship to Pharaoh, right? So who does this sound like in a positive sense? Like who has the same power, equal in power and glory, right? Who actually does mighty works and draws people's worship to another, right? What's that? Okay, like even bigger and greater than Moses. Okay, but who is it that is at work drawing people to worship Jesus? Great, so I think that's what we have here, right? We have a kind of false hope. So this, the first beast is kind of like a false Christ. The second beast functions like a false Holy Spirit drawing people's worship to the beast, right? And so he has the same kind of function as the magicians in Pharaoh. Also, he makes an image of the beast and calls people to worship it. And if they don't worship it, then they're slain. Old Testament stories. When in doubt, we say Daniel, right? Nebuchadnezzar's tower, right? So what would this be? This would seem to be representing some kind of, I think in like ancient Rome, this could have been like ancient Rome had like a Roman cultus, right? The priests of the emperor who were in charge of emperor worship, right? So they represented the emperor. They had power. They had authority. They spoke. They had a prophetic, almost religious-like work of getting people to worship, right? In the same way of Pharaoh's magicians or the implements of Nebuchadnezzar who called people to worship the statue, right? This would seem to be that kind of religious information arm of the state that gets people to worship the state, promotes the state, does mighty works, right? It causes all, right? Small and great, rich and poor, both free and slave. Here we go. You waited this long. You can get the payoff here. To be marked on the right hand or the forehead so that no one can buy or sell unless he has that mark. That is, the number of the beast or the number of its name. This calls for wisdom. Let the one who has understanding calculate the number of the beast, for its number, it is the number of a man, and its number is 666. Okay, let's close in prayer. Come on! Right? So again, this seems to be some form of power that works for the beast to get people to worship the beast, and it marks people with this number, 666. Couple options, right? Number one, literal, right? So every time you say, credit card, they're going to put your credit card on your forehead or on your wrist, right? Okay. And everyone's going to have apparently the same number, 666, right? Possible, right? Numeric, as I've said, though, this isn't the way Revelation tends to use numbers, so I'm not a big advocate of this. A kind of numeric, right? So this one, you may have heard this, that if you take the Greek for Neo Caesar, right? And you transliterate it letter by letter into Hebrew. Hebrew works in such a way that each letter has a corresponding number value. And if you add up all the Hebrew letters of Neo Caesar, it adds up to 666. But it depends how you spell it. Right? So a lot of people have spent a lot of time and energy trying to calculate these numbers. How do you know? But this seems like a huge stretch to me, right? That it's Neo Caesar and that all of John's audience, Greek-speaking audience, would know that if you take a name that he hasn't said and take it in Greek and transliterate it letter for letter into Hebrew, which most of these folks probably didn't speak, and then knew the numbering system for Hebrew numbers and letters, that it would add up to 666 depending on how you spell it. Just, I think most scholars, it's just a bridge too far. It's way too complicated, right? I think this, to read, and that would also be a totally different way to have numbers function than anything that's happening in Revelation. Instead, I think what we're looking at here is symbolic, right? And so 666, that's interesting, right? Because what have all the numbers of this beast been so far? Sevens and sevens. And so it seems that they have what? Fullness, completion, magnitude, power, right? Omnipotence, right? And here I think what he's saying is actually no, right? Incomplete, incomplete, incomplete. Why three? Why three sixes? Yeah, because, well, I think you're right. Like the Bible, biblical, like threes is a way of really emphatic repetition. Holy, holy, holy is the Lord God Almighty, right? We have this kind of false trinity that now is like complete in its incompleteness, right? So it seems to have power over the church. It seems to rule and reign. And yet here is the number, right, that people are marked with who follow this seemingly all-powerful beast. You fail. You fall short. You don't complete the task, right? 666. What's also interesting, if you go back, what is the sixth seal about? Anyone remember the sixth seal? Cosmic comprehensive judgment on all the enemies of God. What is the sixth trumpet about? devastating judgment on all the, you know, the weightiest, heaviest judgment on all the people of God. I mean, all the people who oppose God. And so what we have here, right, it's this emphasis on you come up short, you fail, and you are judged, right? So I think that's what's happening here. You have this seemingly, wow, it gathers worship because it's so awesome, this kind of false trinity of dragon and beast and second beast, often referred to later in the books, the false prophet, right? But there's this subtle statement at the end for the people of God to say, it all ends in emptiness and failure and judgment, right? So that can strengthen you and encourage you as you are in the wilderness under the beast's existence for this period of time. Know this, they seem to have the upper hand. It all ends in judgment for the beast, for the dragon, and for the second beast, and for all the people who are marked by him, right? It seems like it's coming up sevens. It all comes up short. It's all incomplete. It's all inadequate, right? And then we're going to see that's contrasted with, you know, the 144,000 who have the fullness of God's salvation, right? So I think that's kind of how the mark of the beast is best understood, right? Not in a complicated, super, depends how you spell it, numeric system. Not in a literal, but in a sense of the people who rebel against God, there's a mark on them. They think it's the mark of victory, but it's actually the mark of failure and judgment and defeat. So that can strengthen the people of God to say, we don't have to go down with these guys, right? God is preserving us, not in lush circumstances. We're not staying at the Ritz-Carlton. We're in the wilderness, but we're being nourished. How long are we being nourished in the wilderness? 1260 days. How long does the beast rule? The same amount of time. So as long as the beast is ruling and reigning and terrorizing, the people of God are actually being nourished by him for that same period of time. Right? So you can know they're going to lose. God's going to take care of us and nourish us even unto death. And ultimately, as this story progresses, you will see, right? The people of God who are nourished in the wilderness will reign and rule with him in glory. So we can be faithful today. This is a call for the endurance of the saints.